Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Every August 6th, Andy Warhol's birthday, at a quirky little restaurant and ice cream parlor on New York's Upper East Side called Serendipity, there's a seance. About 20 fans and former friends of Warhol's sit around a table, the same table at which Andy sat very often, beginning in the 50s, and ate and held court, and yes, even worked, especially in the early days.
He would be coming in practically 3 or 4 times a day.
Stephen Bruce is one of the original owners of Serendipity.
And then he would say, please save a big table for me because I'm coming with 10 people. And then he would serve espresso and desserts to everyone, and then he would bring out all of his drawings in black and white and supply everyone with India ink pens, and he would have them color all of the drawings. So you might say that Serendipity was Andy Warhol's first factory.
A small wood sculpture image of Andy hangs over the table, and at this yearly event, the group of ex-cohorts tries to conjure him up. Not that you need a seance or a sculpture to see Warhol's image. Just close your eyes and think Andy Warhol, and it's in there, as strong as ever. Warhol's most adored, indelible image was himself, and it was born out of his own adoration of images others had created before him.
On the good ship, lollipop, it's sweet trip to a candy shop.
I think Shirley Temple was Andy's first star.
Victor Bokros knew and worked for Warhol for about a decade, starting in the early 70s. His book, Warhol, The Biography, was published in 1988.
He essentially dreamt himself out of his extremely poverty-struck existence in Pittsburgh as a child via the movies. Shirley Temple was the same age as he was, the same size as he was, and had a similar enough build that he actually then started copying some of her gestures, which turn up later in famous photographs of him taken in the 60s. So it was a very deep fixation.
Warhol had been ill as a child, with a rare form of rheumatism which kept him out of school for long stretches of time. He was at home, making movie star photo collages in his bedroom.
Jean Harlow, Carol Lombard, this is during the Depression, you have to remember, or just after the Depression also. And, of course, this is a sort of sumptuous and rich world which didn't really exist anywhere. This kind of living that you saw on the silver screen, the Fred Astaire hotel life. So Andy really did dream himself into those movies and into those sets.
He would read those Hollywood fanzines, you know.
Bob Colicello was the editor of Warhol's Interview magazine in the 1970s. He, too, wrote a book about Warhol. Holy Terror, Andy Warhol Close Up, was published in 1990.
He just believed in that fantasy of stars, and his whole vocabulary kind of came out of these 1940s movies. He was always talking about, oh, I hope my ship comes in, and oh, then we'll be on Easy Street, and, you know, I got to bring home the bacon.
I'm a commercial person.
Why?
Well, I've got a lot of mouths to feed. Got to bring home the bacon.
Just like in the movies, Andy came to New York and found success as a commercial artist. Ever the fan.
When he came to New York, he stalked Truman Capote, who was at the height of his youthful celebrity.
Tony Sherman is at work on a new book about Warhol, focusing on the Warhol of the 1960s.
Andy worshipped Capote and literally stalked him. A friend of mine told me that he once came across Andy standing outside of 21 in the middle of the afternoon, and Andy started beckoning to his friend frantically, saying, "It's Truman Capote, he's in there." And then Capote, all 5'2" of him, eventually came out of the restaurant and cast a sidelong glance at this flea and hurried on his way.
Once Andy Warhol became a pop artist, there was no stopping him. He was incredibly productive, turning out thousands of paintings, using the images of the stars he admired. Elizabeth Taylor, James Dean, Marlon Brando, Warren Beatty, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis, Jackie. And he went everywhere, to every art show, nightclub, happening, opening, One friend famously joked that Andy would have attended the opening of a bureau drawer.
Andy loved being famous, and his view of life was that when he got up in the morning, he put on a costume and put on makeup as if he was going to play a role in a film or something, or in a play. And then he stepped out of his house and he was on stage.
Andy, do you think that pop art has sort of reached the point where it's becoming repetitious now?
Yes.
Do you think it should break away from being pop art?
No.
Are you just going to carry on?
Yes.
So that he loved that, and he certainly needed it and thrived on it.
This may sound commonplace now, but if it does, it's largely because of Andy Warhol. Andy's fan's eye view of the world, through which he cultivated his own fans, pre-Entertainment Tonight, pre-E-Channel, was quite new.
One of the reasons he loved having the magazine is he could go up to stars and say, "Oh, I'd love you to be on the cover of my magazine." And he could meet anybody by offering them an interview, you know.
And what is true of many celebrities was true of Warhol. The bigger he got, the more starstruck he became.
He was this big star, and people, you know, would sort of jockey to meet him at a club. But, you know, you'd go out with Andy, and he'd be, "Oh, my God, there's Lorna Luft. Oh, there's Lorna Luft. She's such a big star." You know, "Or there's Jan Michael Vincent. Oh, we got to meet him."
In about 1985, Andy was on The Love Boat. And he appeared on stage for something called The 100 Greatest Stars or something that was being photographed for People magazine in L.A. And they got together sort of the 100 most famous people. And he was one of them. And he was really sort of surprised by that and very turned on by it. On the other hand, he had been shot and almost killed in 1968 by a fan, you know, as it were. One of those vague people who he'd met and he'd given a little bit of work to, and you know. And he knew that he was playing a somewhat dangerous game. You know, he knew that he was surrounded by violence, and he just believed that he had a knack to pass through these very violent situations.
Warhol survived the shooting and lived nearly 20 more years. Some thought his work declined in this late period. But the success, the celebrity, never ended. Warhol died in 1987 after surgery to remove his gallbladder. Reportedly, he'd gone into New York Hospital asking an upper-level employee there if there were any big stars in the hospital at the time. "You're the biggest," she said.
When he died, he was more successful than he'd ever been. He was so famous that when he walked into openings in Europe, people used to just burst into tears because they couldn't believe that this man, who seemed so fragile, had survived all this, you know, stuff. He really was an eternal child. He'd had the ability to become an 8-year-old boy, very excited little 8-year-old boy, in just, you know, a second or two in front of you. But suddenly his whole body language would change. You know, he'd go back into that head that was in excited that Shirley Temple sent him a photograph. And so he did live the eternal fan's life.
So at Serendipity in New York, at the Andy Warhol table this August, the seance will proceed as usual.
Of course, we always put a few pieces of lemon ice box pie out on the table during the seance because that was Andy's favorite dessert.
For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fishko.